morning. This is Tom Bones Malone, and you're listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'll see you in the future.
Welcome to Too Much Scrolling for March 26, 2024. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Peter Cottontail.
We're just a couple of guys sitting around talking about things that are important to us. Hopefully they're important to you. If you need more information, there's so many great ways to find more information. This week, Chip, it is spring break. You can hear it in my voice. I am just basking in the joy of not going to work for 7 days.
Well, that sounds lovely. It's a good time to take a stroll down the old bunny trail, Steve.
Easter is coming. Make sure you're making your arrangements and getting your... Do you get the lamb, the butter lamb?
Butter
lamb. So you have to chop off its head in order to have some bread?
Well, exactly, Steve. It's a sacrifice that counts.
Film at 11.
Brings us to our film at 11, our movie of the week. Okay, we need to talk. You go to a lot of movies, and I have a lot of things to do, and I don't get to certain movies. You got to see Ghostbusters Frozen Empire before me. You are going to give us a review, and you're not going to spoil it for me.
So the movie starts.
And then suddenly.
All right. So this is a movie that a lot of people were looking forward to.
Mm-hmm.
And this, it's a franchise, and they want to make it a big franchise.
40 years, 1984, my friend.
That's right. So we really have two stories going on here. One, we have our new family, and Paul Rudd is part of it, and mom, dad, brother, sister is really what it comes down to. And then we have, you know, the Ghostbusters that you grew up with, Steve, who make cameo appearances, but really a lot more than cameos. And they're a different age, Steve. And so we're basically dealing with almost two different groups trying to be put into this one story. And I don't think it's as successful as they would like it to be.
Okay.
This is a story that I feel was meant for, hey, it's October, we're going to have a movie in the park. What would we do that's kind of spooky enough?
Okay.
But family regular. And this is very much in that vein, which means that there's a demographic that this is going for, a lot like Disney's Haunted Mansion, The Ride. Mm. You know, you want to be in the haunted house, you want to see some fun stuff, but you don't want to be too scared.
The thrills are there, but they took out some of the naughty language from 1984, huh?
That's right. So if we wanted to tell us a little bit about the movie, I would say it's a 1980s type of pacing.
Mm-hmm.
Think of like movies like The Goonies.
Okay.
Something like that. Product placement in there because, you know, Cheetos are going to sell Cheetos and Slimer is going to have Slimer. I don't think this is a particularly successful film in what its ambition is. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying that it's just, there's nothing that you're going to leave and go, wow, that was a great film.
Okay.
I will tell you that Dan Aykroyd did his best Art Bell in here. If you remember the old days on, you know, Halloween Eve, you would have Ghost to Ghost that would come on, and Art Bell would listen to ghost stories. Well, Dan Aykroyd's love of the paranormal is so apparent. I mean, he's got this gift for this. And
it's a passion.
And he's our Vincent Price.
Yeah. All right.
If you had to describe him as a person, it's Vincent Price.
All right.
And so I'll say 60 out of 100. I'm being generous here. I didn't say it's bad. I'm just saying that you're not going to go, wow, this is going to be a yearly film I'm going to have to revisit over and over.
As beloved as the original is, it's going to pale in comparison for most people, but they are really pushing the promotion on this one.
Yeah.
Danny Aykroyd did record his voice for Waze, so I did listen to his voice telling me the directions all weekend because I downloaded it on Waze. I don't have a popcorn bucket. Popcorn bucket watch is continuing on Deadwire. But yes, the Ghost Trap popcorn bucket is a big seller. The McHenry Outdoor Theater went a little too far with their promotion of this movie. Chicago got 2 or 3 inches of snow on Friday, so they were not able to show Frozen Empire at the drive-in theater as they expected to. They went a little overboard.
It was a little frozen.
It's a little too cold for Frozen Empire. That's good promotion right there.
I let it go, Steve.
That's different Frozen. That's a different Frozen. You also got to see a very different film. This one's called One Life.
When one watches a film with Sir Anthony Hopkins, Steve.
Mm-hmm. With a nice Chianti.
With a nice Chianti with flava beans. All right, so our movie is One Life. This is starring Anthony Hopkins, along with a number of wonderful cast. This is a wonderful cast. Our story is one that you may have seen on YouTube, maybe the 60 Minutes piece on him. It's a guy named Nicholas Winton. And Nicholas Winton, before World War II started, went over to Czechoslovakia and saw all the poverty that was going on there and all the children that were part of the families there. And you can imagine, listen, just think of Ukraine. Think of what's going on over in Israel. Think of all those young people that are there. And his feeling was, listen, we're taking our children. We are shipping them out into the country. And they're going to be living there because it's dangerous. Mm-hmm. We need to figure out a way to get these children to England so they can be safe. And the idea initially was we will get them to England and families will take them in. And then once the war is over, we'll return them to their families. Now, you can imagine what many of the Jewish families experienced over in Europe when the Nazis came in. Mm-hmm. And many of those families didn't come back. Now, our sort of magic moment where everybody, there's just so much dust in the air in this theater, they really should clean it, where just you could hear people sobbing, was when there's this British program where they invite this gentleman there. And they release his story. They tell everybody about the story. And then everyone in the audience is one of the children. I mean, sorry, they're adults now.
Yeah, this is 50 years after this whole event occurred.
Well, just thinking about it. I mean, yeah. you just kind of break up a little bit. And they all just want to thank him. Mm-hmm. They would be dead if it wasn't for him. And I'm sorry, and his team. He put together a team, and they had to put together resources because they had to pay for applications, and they had to ship them, and all those other stuff, find families to take them in. And like I said, they just became, these kids became part of these British families. Mm-hmm. And over 600 children there. Now, this is a wonderful story. It's an amazing story. This movie is not an amazing movie.
Okay.
I didn't say it's bad. You know, it's one of those films that, you know, it's on television, you get sucked into watching, and you're just kind of going through a movie. You know, I'll say 60 out of 100 for this one, too. Okay. There's nothing that is, the story in itself is amazing.
Okay.
The production is just not as interesting as what the real life story is. They tried. But anyway, this is a movie out there. If you get a chance to see it, enjoy it.
Okay. I finally got a chance to see American Fiction. This is a movie that came out in December, was a winner at the Academy Awards. Yeah. A great story about how we work together as Americans and how we treat each other. The man in this story is trying to write a book, and he is a great writer, and he's got these great ideas, and he writes himself a real joke of a book where he falls into those stereotypes of what a black voice sounds like because he's a black author, and that book sells and goes gangbusters, and he feels like, well, wait a minute, I was kidding when I wrote that. That's garbage writing. Look at my good literature, and looking at life through that lens. Wonderful film.
Now, we reviewed it back in December, mm-hmm. and I gave it very high ratings. And in fact, I said it was one of the best films of the year, if mm-hmm. not the best film of the year. It has multiple endings, like you can pick. what you'd like. But I think you just hit upon it. I think you also get a very genuine understanding. You know, when he wrote the book as a joke, he knew that, and the author who he was kind of mimicking mm-hmm. knew that too. And they eventually had this wonderful conversation, and you can't help but become very empathetic to someone choosing a path that's not yours.
Yeah.
She chose this genre, and she goes, what's wrong with giving people what they want?
Yeah.
Okay. But he, on the flip side of that coin, is asking, this is not how I want to be portrayed, and yet this is what I'm known for. This has got to be Galaxy Quest, where he's like, I am a Shakespeare actor. Mm-hmm. I had this. And, you know, he's caught playing this science fiction. Alan Rickman's character is caught playing the science fiction role mm-hmm. that he just constantly is just like, this Battle. Is not who I am. Mike from Brady Bunch, same thing. And just like, I am a Shakespeare actor. Mm-hmm. And here I am. I'm known playing the father on the Brady Bunch.
There's plenty of actors that take those roles that pay the bills. This is a story of paying the bills. What does it take to be successful in America? Do you sell out? Are you a sellout by doing this work that pays the bills?
Well, you know, there's room for Kid Rock. There's room for your favorite rap artist. There's room for everybody. And even though you may play into what a stereotype is, yeah, it's okay to find an audience. Because, I mean, we all, that's what we're all searching for, right?
I guess.
Yeah. I'm sorry. For small businesses, that's what they're looking for. You don't have to have everybody. You have to have someone. And assuming with the caveat that you're not particularly hurting someone purposely. I mean,
culturally, when an author writes a book that is a ethnic stereotype, like in this story, is that hurting culture? Is that hurting people?
And it's a smart film, and mm-hmm. it doesn't talk down to its audience.
Oh, for sure. Great. Yes, I would suggest American Fiction for sure. Book it. Brings us to our book it, our book of the week. It is the end of the month, and it's time to delve deep this month with our book.
Can we bring in Pam Bedore?
Absolutely. End of the month, it is time for our favorite English professor, Pam Bedore. Good morning.
Good morning, guys. How's it going?
Fantastic. Spring break. It's fantastic.
Steve, I'm ready to become learned. Pam, thank you.
So this month is one of Chip's choices. And Chip, you have chosen Watchmen, the 1986 graphic novel by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons.
Absolutely. So this is was voted as a graphic novel, as a comic strip. Mm-hmm. It was voted as one of the top 100 novels.
By Time Magazine.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So Time's very important at one time, Steve. It's just a website that somebody may own now.
And meta enough, Time is featured in the drawings in this book. And I thought about that when I thought, oh, Time. Time used to be important. Is Time important to this story, Chip?
I think it's very important. Mm. Steve, it's about the watchmaker.
Pam, what are your first impressions of Watchmen?
Okay, so guys, this has been on my to-read list for like 1 million years. And so I was so thrilled when Chip chose it. And I wish I'd had time to read it twice. I have to say, I thought it was fantastic. It's also, there's so much in this volume that I feel like I really, like I wouldn't teach it without reading it at least once more. You know, often you'll read a book once and go ahead and start and invite your students in to come talk about it. Wow. There's just so much going on in this novel.
So I'm going to put this is my fourth time reading this book.
Nice.
So I read the book when it first came out as an individual. So there's 12 chapters in it, 12 books.
Released monthly.
And I don't think as an 18-year-old, 17-year-old, I really got it. Because
how could you?
There was so much going on. I ended up reading again when I was probably 27, 28. I had moved, and it was just one of those things I always had on my shelf. I pulled it out and I reread it. I kind of got it then, but not really getting it. And then the movie came out, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, and I reread it again, along with there was a motion comic. If you go on HBO Max, you can find it. Many times you can find it on YouTube too, where they have a performance of it, of the comic strip. And then I read it for this. So four different times in my life with four different eyes. And each time I marvel at so many stories going on. I still don't understand how he mapped this thing out. I mean, was it a big piece of poster board? And do you just kind of map out the different stories and then how to weave them through and how to do the foreshadowing? And I mean, it just keeps going on and on. And you're right. If you read it again, you'll just pick up so many little clues. In fact, the artwork, you'll pick up a lot of clues too, that you go like, oh, that couple was there and there and there. And I mean, it's pretty, it truly is amazing.
It is definitely a dense story. There's so much to it. And Alan Moore is, a character in this. We think of this story and we think of the mind that created it and whether or not it makes sense in the end, because boy, you have to really delve into that mind. And I don't know if that's a mind that I want to live in for very long. Alan Moore's ideas that he's expressing on the page, there's some dark pieces to this story.
There's a lot of the different perspectives. When you start reading at the end of most chapters, there is a book, a report, or something of that nature. Alan Moore is very gifted at writing at different perspectives that he doesn't necessarily agree with. So, I mean, you're getting different voices from different people. So he's competing, the ideas are competing with themselves too. So he's a kind of chameleon as a writer too.
Well, and one of the things that's so interesting, and I hadn't realized that this, because I've heard of this book many times, this is a totally prototypical postmodern novel. And so I just hadn't thought that. So if I was going to teach this, say, in a graphic novel class in the future, this would be our postmodern novel, and I would introduce the idea of postmodernism, which really comes to play after World War II, in that period of time when people are thinking, oh my gosh, like we had this progress, we had this narrative, meta narrative of technology that was completely based on progress. And now we have to rethink everything after the nuclear bomb. And I think that in terms of being a postmodern novel, like the constellation of features that appear in a postmodern novel are intertextuality, right? So detailed references to other texts. And I've got some things to say about
Oh
that.
boy.
Metafictionality, that's what you were just talking about, Steve, where the author appears almost as a character, and we're constantly reminded that we're reading fiction, parody and pastiche, right? So having a super serious story and making fun of that story at the same time, right?
And the
These are
media
the
that it is a
features,
part of at the same time.
right? And then the fourth big element of postmodernity or postmodernism is actually interrogating our meta narratives. So interrogating things that we just think are kind of set, like the concept of time, for example, right? So in this novel, we are doing those four big things that postmodernism does. Each of them is done at an absolutely genius level, but it also means that you have to read the book four times. And Chip, I'm going to predict right now, you're going to read this book a couple more times in your life and enjoy it just as much. Like, there's so much here. And it's partly because of the genre, I would say.
So I also want to mention this wasn't just Alan Moore. This was Dave Gibbons, who is the artist. He uses a nine panel grid for each of the pages. This was to kind of set you in. This is a comic strip or comic book. At one time they thought it was unfilmable, but I'm going to add something to you to this. John Higgins is the colorist of this, and usually when you think of superhero stories, you're going to be thinking primary colors, so red, Yeah, blue and yellow, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are the colors of this story?
There's not those. I don't see any blue at all. There's green and purple, a lot of those contrasting colors.
So usually the secondary colors are reserved for the bad guys. So this whole book, for the most part, is almost all in secondary colors. So, I mean, that was a conscious decision.
Absolutely.
And that's where you realize the amount of care that was taken into placing this, putting together this story.
And I love that you bring up the colors and the visual elements of this book, which are obviously super crucial, just as the narrative elements are. But I think it's really important that those colors really, one of the meta narratives that's being interrogated is the idea of good and evil, of black and white, of primary versus secondary. Like each of these characters is both an antagonist and a protagonist, right? We don't have that distinction. That's so common in superhero texts.
Absolutely, turning it on its ear. That there's no doubt that that is what Alan Moore had in mind, was turning the idea of that superhero narrative on its ear.
Sure. So whether you're talking about 007, James Bond, Superman, whoever you're thinking, the good guys and the bad guys,
Doctor Who,
everything kind of gets
Sherlock Holmes.
everything kind of gets muddied in this.
Sure. And boy, is it muddied and dirty and smelly, and this is a hard book to read. There's so many psychological questions that are being brought up in this text. I had a real hard time getting through the hard childhood that Rorschach experienced, and the reality of his workings of his mind. And boy, oh boy.
It's interesting you bring up Rorschach. There's a couple things that I will make note of this. First of all, Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons were shocked. Not that this wasn't well received, but because of this book and Frank Miller's The Dark Knight about Batman, we basically are just coming out of where everybody is dirty and gritty and, basically psychopaths all the time. And so Alan Moore did not anticipate this becoming the dominant theme through movies. You see it, and you watch a lot of movies. They're all using this as a reference, and that's too bad, because he actually later on wrote something much more uplifting and light, and it was basically a response. Like, you don't have to write where this everything is just dark and negative. The other thing I want to bring up is Rorschach is based off of a Charlton character called The Question, and also a secondary character called Mr. A. And those were Steve Ditko. Steve Ditko's characters, he created Spider-Man and he created Doctor Strange. The Question and Mr. A are both independent characters, or were independent at one time, that were based on Ayn Rand's philosophy, objectivism. And so Steve Ditko is a big was an objectivist, and he spent a lot of time in their world. There's black, there's white, there's good, there's evil, there's no in between, and there's no compromise. And we see that in how he sees the world, and sort of how it took him out of, and he is not, I'm sure a person who's an objectivist would look at it and say, yeah, this is not the positive side of objectivism. But it plays its way. He's the what is interesting is he's the crazy guy that everyone kind of looks at and goes, oh, let's follow this crazy guy through the whole book. But ultimately, he's the only guy that sees the truth. He's the only one who sees it from the beginning. He's seeing it put together, and even at the end, he's not going to compromise. And there's a result of that.
And I think his name is really important, obviously, because the Rorschach test has this perspective. Like everyone has a different perspective when they look at the same thing. And obviously, that's one of the big themes of this novel, is that we each bring our own intellectual but also ethical perspective on really big themes and questions. And so Rorschach I think has that complexity built into the single character that is also built into cultural and societal approaches to deep questions.
And each one of the characters gets roughly a chapter to kind of work through these people. They're all complex. They
Right.
all have, they're all, for some reason, we tend to gravitate towards this uncompromising character. But I mean, you can see the disconnect with Dr. Manhattan,
Yes.
or his wife, or the gentleman who plays Owlman. They all have their good parts. The reason why they are superhero, Owlman's always prepared. He always has these insights. And then we get to Ozymandias, who is the smartest man in the world, outsmarts a god, which is ultimately what Dr. Manhattan gets to play. Anyway, they're a lot of fun, aren't they? We should probably ask some questions about it.
Now that we've gotten through the plot, because that is not even getting through the plot, we've
That
now
is not
hit the
even
groundwork.
touching the plot, Steve.
I notice in our notes there is no plot summary in there.
No.
The next thing we're going to talk about, there's going to be pirates, right? That's the next thing
Yes.
you're going to tell me.
And this is the thing, even the very fact that we can't really easily come up with a quick plot summary of this novel. Or, yeah, I mean, even saying the premise is this is a little bit tough. Is that this is really just like an ethically and epistemologically complex story? Because you're really looking at, like, how do we say what is good and evil in a world after the atomic bomb? But also, how do we even know what's real as
Wait a
we
second.
approach the end of the 20th century?
You didn't tell me I needed to fire up
Yes, we're getting into philosophy, and here comes Chip. Go ahead.
Steve, the hookah has got to be set
The
up.
lava lamp is right over there.
But I mean, okay, that's not my metaphor for these conversations, but these are
But
the
Chip.
conversations that are happening in this book, right?
Absolutely. This is
You knew
definitely.
it, Chip. When you chose this book, you knew it.
All right, so there's some things that I will mention on this. If you are a person who is not familiar with this era, you could think of climate change on what it's doing to young people right now. So we were young people during that time, and it was the atomic bomb. They could drop it any time, Steve. And you're supposed to get under the desk because that will save you, Steve.
Those Cold War fears are very well spelled out in this, for sure.
So the end of the world could come. It's a different world than ours, but similar enough. Because instead of Nixon not being reelected, he's in his fourth term right now. And we've got J. Gordon Liddy going on there. These are the Watergate people that are involved in here. So we have all these references to the real world. So a person who is from that era should be able to put together this. There was a world in the 40s where there was a superhero. Like the rise of the superheroes. Think of Superman and stuff like that. Eventually, in the 70s, they just outlawed it. So it goes away. You're not allowed to be a superhero anymore. They go away. And then what we're having right now is sort of how would you use a being like Dr. Manhattan, who has the power to stop the world? He is beyond an atomic bomb. And because the United States has him, everyone else is at their mercy, as in they're not going to be aggressive. So we effectively have some world peace-ish, but everyone is on edge, right?
Well, and one of the big moral and epistemological questions that really traverses this novel is like, what are the appropriate or possible ways to attain world peace? Right. And this is a very radical answer that interrogates all of our assumptions about what constitutes peace and security.
And Reagan said something in the 1980s similar to this. He said, imagine there was an attack from outside this world. And what would the world do? We're divided on Earth, but if the threat is from outside, we would be as one, or at least that would be the hope.
And Will Smith said, "Welcome to Earth."
Ha 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 ha.
I'm contributing.
Well, guys, this is a really serious question. Is there a way to conceptualize peace between the actors on Earth without imagining an external threat? Right?
Well, I think that Ozymandias had his answer to mm-hmm. that.
And I think the vigilantes had their answer, that they think that vigilanteism, getting out there and protecting the people, is the right choice. And boy, it seems like Alan Moore disagreed with that a lot in this storytelling.
Well, he also, this was a whether you know it or not, this was a commentary against Reagan, mm-hmm. And he's an English Thatcher at the time. So there was certainly a commentary, and not explicitly against them individually, but of that, the philosophy of that time. And he is a very American liberal, not international liberal as it was designed, and American liberal.
And this is such an America-centric story. This is not an English story in any shape.
The English, though, are kind of fascinated by the United States.
Of course, especially in 1986 when this was published. And I found it fascinating to see from his perspective what America meant to him in 1986.
Sure.
And I think one of the really, I think, incredibly compelling ways that he does the sort of epistemological questioning is each chapter has a sort of tagline, and they're all intertextual. And some of them you recognize, some of them you don't. Uh-huh. So, I mean, maybe some people recognize all 12. I certainly didn't. I'm guessing, most people might not. But even the title of this novel, Watchmen, mm-hmm. refers to, it comes from this old Roman poet who watches the watchmen. But in fact, as a person who studies the beginning of policing in the United States, this was a huge question in 100 years earlier than this, in the 1840s, 50s, 60s, was if we actually pay people to police, and it started, New York was the first city to get a police force, and Chicago was right behind it with Alan Pinkerton. If we hire people to police their fellow citizens, mm-hmm. who's going to watch the watchmen, right? And so it's a question that was much more vocally debated in the U.S. than in the U.K. or Europe, honestly. So that's kind of a fun element of why this might be said in the U.S. because of that history of policing never being quite comfortable with American cultural identity.
And this is a huge topic for a lot of libertarian or classically liberal arguments, is the idea of, the police or people you give power to become enforcers. So as much as you may like the union becomes the enforcer to the employees. As much as you like the police department, they become the enforcer by who could be in power. Mm-hmm. And so you see the good and the bad of it. The nice part is they can, listen, in an emergency situation, everything's cool. Mm-hmm. But you also, you can imagine there's a group of people in the United States that feel that they work against them. And many minorities feel that at times too. Mm-hmm. So, this is not something that just goes away. This is a big story on how to use your enforcers in society.
And then I think that structurally, each chapter gets this tagline that references a huge philosophical conundrum, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's really fun because, and I think, again, the visuals are so compelling, so powerfully done. And so when you get your tagline for the chapter, which happens in page 1, 2, or 3 of each chapter, then you kind of, if you recognize it, you have this sort of philosophical question in the back of your mind, right? So like chapter 4, it's just a single word, watchmaker, right? So this is the sort of question of, where do we come from? Does God exist? Is the question that's raised by the word watchmaker. Mm-hmm. It references this huge philosophical argument with Paley in the 18th century, and then Darwin, of course, who specifically uses that in Origin of Species. So this idea, like, if you have a designed world, if you have a watch, you need a watchmaker behind it, right? If you have time, you need a concept of time behind it. Or do you? Right? And as we move even further into the 21st century, the number of people who actually believe in a higher power is decreasing, decreasing, decreasing.
But most people still believe in time. Dr.
Yeah.
Manhattan certainly gives us a very intriguing view into the concept of time in his chapter.
Well, there's a big part is he's seeing the past, the present, and the future all at the same time. And Miss Jupiter keeps, or Mrs. Jupiter keeps asking him that if he knows how it ends, what's the purpose? Are we just puppets? And so that there's where it kind of keeps going, like, oh.
Fate, destiny, kismet.
And he goes, I can't see. There's a part that's cloudy for me, which is ooh, which is brilliant. Once
Cloudiness.
again, shows the brilliance of Ozymandias of creating a some kind of distortion.
And I really love a scene between those two that's on Mars. Oh shit, I'm on Mars, says Miss Jupiter. And Dr. Manhattan says, of course, it is here on Mars that we debate Earth's destiny. John, please, I mean, this just being here, it's giving me problems, okay? I can't take your predestination trip right now. And he says, why does my perception of time distress you? And we, the reader, are like, oh my God, it's so distressing. She says, why ask? You already know my answer. It's stupid. When I left you, when Nova Express attacked you, you were surprised. Why, if you knew it would happen? Everything is preordained, even my responses. And you just go through the motions, acting them out? Is that what you are? The most powerful thing in the universe? And you're just a puppet following a script? I love that. Sorry to read such a long passage,
No,
but it's
it's
so well laid out. Like, this is a huge philosophical conundrum that people have been talking and debating. And he just lays it out in three little panels between these two characters. And we see the back of them too. So visually, it's so cool. I want to know why Dr. Manhattan is naked throughout this business, this blue naked dude, but we have to talk about that. But as we see them walking away, they're having this conversation that so nicely elicits thoughts that each of us has had in terms of do we or do we not believe in fate or predestination or free will?
We've talked about this so many times. We've read so many books that have touched on the idea of free will. Is there free will? Is our DNA driving our decisions? Do we really truly make decisions? Or is there some sort of creator that is pulling the strings on our puppetry?
So
Did Chip
this.
choose this book, or were we always meant to read it, honestly?
Ooh, very, very.
Sorry.
Well, the lights are down low now. All right, so we should also mention that this human that is given this godlike power, pretty much to do anything, is slowly losing his humanity, and the wife is put there to keep him at least connected, and they're walking Mars, and ultimately he chooses to have some humanity at the end. But he really is getting to the point where should I care about humans? Why should I care about humans any more than I care about anything else in the universe, dead or alive? So,
Now or past or future.
and I just want to point out that the funny line there, because there's plenty of funny things that happen in this. The character that says, "Yeah, Dr. Manhattan left. He went to Mars." Since the Manhattan Transfer, that has been a thing. And the other character goes, "Did you just make a joke? Did you just say the Manhattan Transfer?" And I was like, "Yes, they did."
So, guys, why is Dr. Manhattan naked and blue?
Because he's so inhuman. He tried to wear clothes in one scene, and it just didn't work for him because it's not, he's not human, period.
Well, I think I mentioned he's losing his humanity because originally they gave him a costume, like a superhero costume. And as you see it, it keeps gets it's all right, now he's got whatever he's wearing, then it becomes less, then it becomes just some a Speedo. Then eventually it doesn't matter. he doesn't care anymore. He's losing connection to the world, and you know, he's got nothing to hide, or he just wants to show it off.
Do you think it's a reference to the Garden of Eden and the Tree of Knowledge? Do you think it's a reference to this notion that, you know, in one big narrative of God, we actually have these two humans, and the first thing they find out when they get knowledge is they find out that they're naked and that they must cover up. And in some ways, this is a total rejection of that, you know, early Christian narrative that frames gender too, because I think that's the other thing I find interesting is that he does have his gendered bits, but they're quite like statue, you know, he kind of like when you see him from the front, which is very seldom, in fact, he's got that Greek statue genitalia, that makes him look more like a work of art than like a sexualized human man.
Sure.
I don't know. It feels like there's some kind of deeper stuff. There's like a rejection of meta narrative going on here as well.
There was a lot of discussion of that in the latest TV version of this as well, because his genitalia was very different in the latest TV version. Again, very statuesque, very much an idealistic kind of shape. But yes, there was a lot of conversation about that.
So I should mention that the television show and the movie's different, and the television show officially comes after this, but this is a self-contained story.
Agreed.
And Alan Moore has nothing to do with any of those other things. And he will make sure he tells you that over and over and over.
Yes. I think he's maybe verbalized that.
And so any type of writings that have been after this are not related, other than the IP is not owned by him.
So, Pam, I just need to ask you, chapter 5, how do you pronounce those two words?
Fearful symmetry?
Oh, symmetry. You don't say symmetry?
I mean, you can. I'm going to read to you from William Blake. You knew I would have to. I'm sorry. Blake, like my favorite romantic film. Yeah,
that's me setting you up for William Blake.
Sorry. But I was delighted. Of course, I turned the page and I'm like, oh, fearful symmetry. It comes from Blake's The Tiger.
And I said symmetry.
Well, and I understand why you do that. So this comes from William Blake's set of paired poems. And this comes out of his poems of innocence and experience. And so he has these two wonderful sets of poems, and they have partners. There's one poem in the innocence book and one poem in the experience book. So the lamb is in the innocence book, and there's tons of really Christian readings going on about that. But the little lamb who made thee, and it feels like a very religious one. And then the tiger is the experience part. And in the end of the tiger, the final stanza, I'll just read to you. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night. What immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry?
Thank you.
A tree. I don't know. But this notion that fearful symmetry, you can't have good without evil. You can't have utopia without dystopia. You can't have the lion without, or the lion or the tiger without the lamb. And so you can't have a predator without prey. And so this notion of sort of distinctions of black and white, but then Alan Moore and postmodernity's project of messing those things up and making it really hard to see what's good and evil, and saying like, maybe we need more complex framings of meta narratives that we thought were pretty simplistic. Like, that's good, that's bad.
I'm going to add one more to your list, and that is predictability versus unpredictability.
Yes,
the idea that we have this life, that this is going to happen in this life, and you can't have that normal, quote unquote, normal without that unpredictable factor to it.
Isn't that what kind of models do, though? You have a, you're taking data from a data set, you know, and you're trying to forecast it out. You've got a group that is more likely to happen. They're not likely to happen.
Sure.
Okay, we're in the middle of the NCAA tournament, right? So there are times that anyone could win.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always the outlier that is a possibility. It's just more unlikely to happen.
Hmm.
So the idea that you can plan your life with every beat, well, how lovely would that be? But a lot of it, though, comes as like the outliers have an impact. People get sick. Someone gifts you multiple millions of dollars. You visit something that changes your perspective. All these things that happen in life change the future outcomes. Once again.
And makes you question the morality of those choices. How do we use morality to predict how other people are going to act when it's unpredictable?
And statistics is an epistemological frame, right? Statistics is a way of seeing, just like religion is a way of seeing. Right? And then when we go to chapter six, we get the very, very famous Nietzschean quote, "The abyss gazes also." And I had to go get the quote because I didn't know it. Like, I know the blank, but Nietzsche I had to look up. So this comes from the quote, "He who fights with monsters might take care lest he thereby become a monster. And if you gaze for long into an abyss, the abyss gazes also into you." Oh, that's so good. That's poetry, man. That's philosophical poetry right there.
Keanu, whoa.
Yeah,
Like,
I just think back to the Zoom days where I was gazing into the abyss, where the students' little black little cameras, and I was trying to teach them something, and the abyss was gazing back at me, and it really affected me.
well, make sure, I think the telling part of this, though, is that, you fight the monster, you become the monster. And, think about everything going on in the world and how, you think you're doing good, military actions, any other place, we're liberating or whatever. But, at the turn, you could be that bad person too.
Yeah. There's so much to this. It's so dense. It's so full of philosophy and thinking, and it's so relevant to what we're doing today. That some of the themes of those questions of what is America's role in the world certainly are still a part of what we're talking about all these years later.
Yeah, it does become very helpful. Great books like George Orwell's 1984, you bring up in conversations because it becomes a touchstone, like, oh, he described something to explain something. This book has a lot of places that you could pull out, assuming that enough people had have read it to go, oh, yeah, this is like this part. And maybe it helps illuminate something that people are having a difficult time understanding.
And I think it's such a tapestry. Like when I think, ooh, who would I teach this book to? There's too much to just put it as one of 10 books in a 14-week graphic novel class. You almost have to have a whole class on this book
Wow.
because, each of the 12 chapters has so much going on in it, has so many intertextual references. And then I also just want to note how generically complex this is. It starts with a murder mystery, right? We literally start with a dead body on page one, right? So it's a detective story.
Is this a
It's
joke?
also what?
The comedian. He was saying that the comedian, is this a joke?
Oh my gosh. But we have obviously the superhero narrative. And then we also have science fiction. This won the Hugo Award for crying out loud. Comic books don't always win the Hugo Award, but it's very well situated to win a science fiction and fantasy award. It just has all of these different pieces. And in terms of the philosophies it references, we've got Darwin, we have romantic poetry, we have Nietzsche, we also have Carl Jung. In chapter nine, our tagline is "the darkness of mere being." And I had to find the quote for that too. "The sole purpose of existence is to kindle a light in the darkness of mere being." So acknowledging that sort of anxiety that we have, like, what if there is no meaning to life? Our purpose is to kindle a light, to create an illumination around why this is worth it, this whole endeavor.
There are multiple references to Prometheus in this
yes.
also. And so what, man stealing the light from God, stealing fire. I mean, what is
the science?
Whoa.
Yeah. The science. Yeah. I got nothing.
But I would say, like, the 12 volumes of this book, each of them acts as a kind of piece in a tapestry that uses the figure of the superhero. And I think, you guys correct me if I'm wrong, like, Dr. Manhattan's the only one who actually has supernatural abilities, right?
Yes.
I think it's not like one of those superhero worlds where each person has their own supernatural ability. Like, this is a bunch of humans who are trying to make a difference and trying to play out their own moral code on a large scale. And so the tapestry of supernatural versus natural, you know, the mad genius versus insanity, right? Like, that figure of Manhattan as a mad genius. So we just have element after element after element after element, and you just get so deeply embedded in this really, really complex narrative.
So we start coming to the end of chapter, well, they kind of figure it out maybe in 10, chapter 10. And then 11, they confront him. He goes, oh yeah, it's already happened. And then we get to, so it's like the Incredibles, the Pixar movie, where the bad guy, he goes, oh, you caught me monologuing. So what do we get? Ozymandias is totally monologuing. Mm-hmm. And they go, oh, but we're here to stop you. And he's like, well, it's already happened. And then their last chapter, it's just big splash pages at the beginning, yeah. And just kind of showing what the result of that was.
Well, and there's also this alternate history piece that goes throughout, right? Where you have, like, the world is recognizable, but with some substantial differences, as you've already pointed out, Chip. And that notion that these certain pivotal moments in history just create this completely, open up this completely new story, this completely new book of history. That's a really fascinating idea too, that goes with temporality, goes with multiple universes, mm-hmm. goes with simulation hypothesis. It's all in this 300-page graphic novel.
And our result from Ozymandias is all those deaths. Mm-hmm. And he goes, but look at all the people I've saved. Mm-hmm. I mean, is he a bad guy or a good guy?
Blurring those lines is certainly one of the things that Alan Moore was trying to show us in that black and white world of superheroes.
And he's playing a king, right? He's playing, you know, Ramsay II. Leaders at times are being asked, he was an elected leader, by the way, mm-hmm. are being asked to make decisions that are going to impact lots and lots of people. So, I mean, it keeps begging questions that you take over and over and over and over. And then, you know, what does Owlman realize? He goes, ah, well, yeah, it worked. And yeah, we shouldn't undo this. And Rorschach is like, never compromise. Truth is truth. Never compromise.
Wow.
Oh, and truth is so not truth. And someone named Rorschach should know that.
Well, and there's the point, is he's not aware.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's not aware, but Alan Moore is showing that there are lots of different perspectives, mm-hmm. and they are coming to different conclusions on how to deal with things. And, Dr. Manhattan has a final confrontation, and he rips his mask off. So he's not Rorschach at that moment. And Dr. Manhattan kills man, or at least the one that had the knowledge. Hmm. I'm sorry, willing to share the knowledge.
And then I find it very interesting that after that huge culminating scene, we get two more scenes. You know, I love to look at endings, my friends. So newsflash, we get this very, like, simple scene of, you know, Girl brings boy home to meet mom, right? And it kind of takes it from that huge cultural species level disaster scenario to like why any of this matters, which is meeting someone, falling in love, making sure your parent approves of your partner, right? There's this really, really small story that it goes to. And then flip to the very final page, and we get the newspaper. How are we going to present on this? How are we going to tell this story? And it's like, oh, everyone's hungry, there's deadlines, right? Like, how does history even become? Because when you're looking at, history from the past, you count on those microfiche representations of the newspapers of the day. Well, who wrote that and how? It's just these schlubs who are like trying not to get ketchup on their shirt, trying to decide, oh yeah, he says, one of them says, I guess we'll have to get something from the crank file for today's newspaper. So this notion that so many stories are actually lost to history. History itself as a meta-narrative doesn't always hold.
In addition, that newspaper, that crank paper, that National Enquirer, it's just a product too. It's just a product. The news that you watch is just a product.
It's put together very often very randomly, right? With many, many random elements that go into the decision making, and we count that as history.
Wow. I'm completely stunned by this book. This is not my style of book. This is not, I was very disturbed by the disturbing parts and very deeply interested in the conversation about who we are, especially in the United States, especially in the era that we're in, with all of these ideas stacked on top of each other.
And they're all just as relevant today as they were in the mid-80s. It's so, you could picture so many interesting projects to give students working with this book. It's just that you would have to spend the entire semester on it to really get anywhere. So I don't know.
What's the
So
title of
thanks,
the class,
Chip.
Professor? It's
Thanks.
called Watchmen.
Right? I mean,
Told in 12 parts.
no, but I mean, we do teach Paradise Lost over a whole semester, also in 12 volumes. Like, I mean, I'm really serious that you would almost need a whole semester to really do this book, even the remotest kind of justice.
There are books written about this, and
Sure.
academic books, obviously, because it's a complex story. There's just, you can pull it apart in many, many ways.
And I'll be honest, there aren't as many as I expected. I looked at the peer-reviewed journals, and there's only like six or eight articles on this.
Okay.
I was expecting hundreds. And I don't know if people, I don't know what that's about. I don't know if it's partly the decision to tell it in graphic novel format or if it's still settling. I could imagine that there might be, especially now with the movie and the TV shows and stuff, there might be a resurgence of scholarship on this because it's very fascinating.
What do you think of Alan Moore's done? First of all, he's retired from writing comics now, and he's had a number of important works. He's considered the best writer of the comic form. He's doing an interview for The Guardian, and he talks a little bit about superhero movies. And this book, by the way, along with Frank Miller's The Dark Knight about Batman, has set the tone for so many years. And he's talking about today's political climate. And basically he's suggesting that, let's see, I said around 2011 that I thought that it had serious worrying implications for the future of millions of adults who were queuing up to see Batman movies because of that type of infantilization, that urge towards simpler times, simpler realities, that can very often be a precursor to fascism. He points out that when Trump was elected in 2016, and when we ourselves took a bit of a strange detour in our politics. Many of the biggest films were superhero films. And so my question is, because we are having a rise of nationalism, certainly maybe isolationism a little bit too. And there seems to be a sort of a revisiting of some of the stuff that was maybe in the 1890s, 1900s, where, you know, America first, we're by ourselves, that type of thing, rather than seeing ourselves part of the greater part. What do you think about his insight? Because this book certainly shows the superheroes don't always have all the answers. They may be smarter than us. They may have different skill sets and all this other stuff. They may be able to do things that the average person can't do. But, you know, they're living as a childhood medium.
Well, I think, too, that the Keen Act in this novel that stops superheroes, we could read that as the idea that you can't really stop people from sharing their perspectives, right? You can make laws that make things illegal, but people will still find ways to perform the identities that they care about, right? So this notion, because these superheroes, they're not supernatural, except for Dr. Manhattan. So this idea, like, you're not allowed to put on a costume and go out there and protect your city. Well, people do it anyway, right? And so there's a real question about how much power the state has. And obviously, this is a huge question that we have today, right? Like, what's the power of the people versus the power of the state? And wait, if you're living in a democracy, aren't the people the state? Maybe not. You know, the question of, does power corrupt, right? In what ways? All of these questions are in this novel. And I don't think Moore provides us answers, just really asks us to think through these issues by figuring them through these superheroes.
I mean, who watches The Watchmen?
Right, exactly.
It's all laid out for us as a philosophical conversation about who we are, and adding into that the fate concept versus free will, and who is measuring who we are and what we can do, and the legislative piece. There's so much to this conversation.
And very importantly, not only who we are, but who we have been and who we want to be.
True.
Right? That temporal element to it is hugely important, like trying to understand our past in order to imagine our future, but without laying it out as three completely distinct times, because there's bleeding between past, present, and future. Do we all feel like we understand this so much better now that we've talked about it for an hour, or do we think
not at all? Not at all. I feel like I need to read it three more times, and I feel like I need some trigger warnings so that I don't read certain pieces of it.
That's
two Alan Moore pieces that we've discussed. We've discussed From Hell, and then we've discussed this. What do we think of Alan Moore?
He is definitely a philosopher, being able to verbalize these thoughts in such a provocative way. He's a provocateur and a philosopher. I am not willing to fall into his trap, but I am willing to think through these ideas.
You're no wizard, Steve.
I am no wizard.
And he's also a postmodern philosopher. I just want to really clearly state that. He's a postmodern philosopher who's interrogating all of our assumptions, all of our cultural meta-narratives.
Yeah.
What Pam said. It's a very specific type of philosophy.
Pam, thank you so much for joining us and giving us so much background and so much knowledge on this. This is a very intriguing story that I'm sure that we will talk about more as we get into more books.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. And thank you for finally putting this book, which, let's face it, is pretty intimidating by its reputation, as well as when you open page one. Thanks for taking it off my to read list and putting it on my to read again list.
Agreed.
So thanks, you guys. Great to see you.
Great to see you. That's Watchmen, published in 1986 by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons.
Scroll with it.
Brings us to our scroll with it. Do you hear the smile on my face?
Steve, you know, one of the beautiful things about being in a large city is having the opportunity to see so many wonderful events.
Yes.
And we had a choice of many wonderful events this last weekend, but you chose to start off your journey in Joliet, Steve, home of Dairy Queen and Tasty Freeze.
Yes, Joliet is a magnet for my life because I say out loud that my favorite movie of all time is The Blues Brothers that was created in the late 1970s and put out on our screens in 1980.
It stars Princess Leia, Steve.
Yes, Carrie Fisher is certainly a big part of my love for this movie, but I love the Blues Brothers. I am I'm not published in many places, but in my senior yearbook, there's a picture of me in a black fedora and sunglasses dressed as a Blues Brother.
Doing some dancing?
Yeah, doing a little foolish dancing for sure. I got a chance this weekend to meet two of the members of the Blues Brothers band. Blue Lou, Lou Marini, and Tom Bones Malone were in town this weekend, and I spent the whole weekend just fawning over them and their work from the last 45 years.
So you first met them in person when you were out in Joliet. And then you got to head out to the horse racing capital of the world, Steve, the breeding capital of the world. Well, at one time it was Dixon, Illinois, home of Ronald Reagan.
That's right. The childhood home of Ronald Reagan and the place to see master bluesmen practicing their craft. They played with the Dixon Municipal Band on Saturday night and blew the doors off the place. This was so much fun. A great concert after a great discussion of the history of music and the Blues Brothers and Saturday Night Live and all the things I love that we got to hear on Thursday.
How can a guy that green have the blues that bad, Steve?
I had so much fun, Chip. I also got a chance to go down and be a part of the Streets Alliance Artisan Market at Imperial Oak Brewing in Willow Springs.
I heard they had beer there, Steve.
Yes, they did. Delicious, delicious beer that I got to be a part of that community of artists. And Sunday night, I attended Bruce Fest, the celebration of Bruce Campbell. I'll talk more about that next week. Spoilers.
Not Bruce Springsteen, Steve.
The other Bruce. The other charismatic Bruce. Bruce Campbell just throwing out all of his knowledge and philosophy.
So, Steve, this is also a time of holidays. And as Holy Week begins, tell us a little bit about the holiday today.
Yes. Happy Rose Day, everybody. The 19th anniversary of the first episode of Doctor Who from the reboot in 2005. Happy Rose Day, everyone.
Nerd.
My calendar is full. I don't know about you, but my calendar is full of this kind of stuff.
Well, you know, sometimes we have, you know, okay days, Steve, but Friday is...
Really, Good Friday.
It's a Good Friday,
It's a Good
Steve.
Friday. It's almost great. It's almost a great Friday. Good Friday on Friday, Easter on Sunday, and then Monday, back to school for me, April Fool's Day.
Well, at least they titled it correctly, Steve.
For sure. Coming up on the future calendar, the eclipse, the full total eclipse of the sun is coming.
That's the following Monday, the 8th.
Mm-hmm.
And so our closest ways of getting there, if you're in the Chicago area, would be either down towards St. Louis, going towards Carbondale,
correct,
SIU's campus, mm-hmm, Southern Illinois, or you can go towards Indianapolis, mm-hmm, which is... I heard it's a big city in Indiana.
Or you can go to Austin, Texas and celebrate a full day of fun down there. The counties in Texas have declared a state of emergency for this day because they're concerned that so many people are going to be flocking to this very small band of the country as we watch that celestial event, an amazing, and I say the word amazing all the time, but in this case, I really mean it. It is a amazing moment.
Well, it's 3.5 to 4 minutes. Mm-hmm. It is a celestial dance. And, you know, life may end, Steve.
Well,
it could be the end of the world.
The weird part is that usually a full solar eclipse is a once-in-a-lifetime event, but this is one of three times in a very short amount of time that we have the ability to go to the right place to see it.
And if you're debating whether to go or not,
go.
Your next chance is 2044. So, you know,
go.
You can travel. I mean, Carly Simon could sing about you. You're so vain. And
total eclipse of the heart?
Well, no. Carly Simon wrote about that you flew up to Nova Scotia. But, you know, my point on this is that it's going to be a while. And it's the type of event to take your kids out of school and to Please. Go. And so San Antonio, Austin, Dallas, you keep going up, you get to, you know, Carbondale, Indianapolis, Dayton, Cleveland, and it goes through Maine. So you've got a path, you can find it online. But the special part is everything does stop.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to, you can help out NASA.
Yeah, they're looking for data on this. They want your smartphone data. They want to know where you're at and whether your particular viewpoint has a certain piece of that happening. The idea here is checking the sun's oblateness. They have an app NASA is putting out. It's called Sun Sketcher. You're going to use your phone's camera to record the event to help the study of how all of that celestial movement happens.
You can be one with the world, Steve.
There you go. I suggest...
Hands across America.
That's a different day. I suggest highly that you find a way to be a part of this. When we went couple of years ago, it was significant. It was a significant moment that I will never forget.
So 2017, I was actually on the SIU campus in Carbondale. I got a tour from the campus, from the dean. And then there was a meteorologist who was given the day off. In fact, his buddy, who was also a meteorologist, took the entire day's schedule so his friend could be there and see it. I mean, you can imagine this. You studied this stuff all your life. There was a guy in his 90s from Canada, and he made his way down because he wanted to see a total eclipse. Interestingly enough, the eclipse is going through his town this time.
Mm-hmm.
And families were from all over. There was a family from California who at the last minute bought plane tickets and had the kids just convince them, we've got to go see this. It can be life-changing because, one, you never get to see things on this scale.
Right. And you have a little bit of a story to tell. On your way back, you got stranded because there were so many people streaming out of the area that you had a hard time getting back. So that is a tale to tell for everybody who's thinking about going somewhere and to catch this in April.
So the reason I'm going to Indianapolis for this is going to be that during the eclipse is around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And then that evening, the NCAA, which is based out of Indianapolis, the national championship, the basketball, men's basketball championship is that night.
Hmm.
It's not in Indianapolis. It's down in Phoenix.
Okay.
But, you know, I'm going to be at the headquarters area.
There you go.
And so we get to do that. My reasoning for that is my experience driving back after the eclipse. Once again, it's only going to last 5 minutes or so. You're going to be down in a long way away.
Uh-huh.
And my drive from Carbondale back to Chicago, it was bumper to bumper. Think of the deepest traffic you have. And this is a 5-hour drive when there's no traffic.
Mm-hmm.
It's bumper to bumper all the way back. I eventually stopped at a rest stop and just went to sleep and woke up the next morning and drove home.
Sure.
I begged my children to come with me.
Yeah.
And of course they said, no, Dad. So your kids are going to say, no, Mom and Dad, go ahead and go.
Yeah, find a way. Find a way to get there. That is my suggestion.
You know, and that reminds me is that we have 6 degrees of separation from many, many people in this world, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
But the one that's most important is who?
Kevin Bacon. Kevin Bacon is a saint amongst actors. He's got so much going on, so many great charities that he's a part of. 6 degrees is his big charity.
And he has bacon in his name, Steve.
He has bacon in his name. How can you go wrong?
And, you know, just remember, it's on Easter week, and the most important person is Kevin Bacon, right?
The story that came up this week, the Utah school that was featured in the movie Footloose 40 years ago, they are closing their doors. They are relocating at the end of this school year. So they begged, they asked, they did everything they could to get Kevin Bacon to come to the prom at the end of the year. And he agreed he's going to be there for these kids.
Isn't Kevin Bacon, isn't that the fun part about being an actor
mm-hmm.
who's had a wonderful career? And certainly, they get to be playful later on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Kevin Bacon seems to enjoy that. By the way, he played Chip in Animal House. Just wanted to
just throw putting that out there.
Yeah. But anyway, Footloose is his, I guess.
I would say it's his biggest hit. I think he certainly has a huge library of movies that have been successful, but I think he's most known for Footloose.
And so why isn't Kenny Loggins there?
He might be. I don't know. You look around. See if you can find Kenny Loggins.
Maybe they can cut loose.
It's all right. Nobody worry about me. No, that's Caddyshack. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Who's this Chip guy? I'm Peter Cottontail. Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
We want to thank everybody for listening and thank Pam Bedour for coming in and talking about Watchmen. Very, very deep philosophical conversation. We will be working on that for the whole semester, apparently. Thanks, Professor Pam. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4TMS. Our website is TooMuchScrolling.com. Our email is TooMuchScrolling@gmail.com. We're on all of the social medias. We're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and YouTube. And you can always ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Peter Cottontail.
Kevin Bacon.
We'll see you next week.
We'll see you next week.